You're listening to In Your Company on Cambridge 105.
Welcome to In Your Company, the fortnightly business show on Cambridge 105, presented by me, Sam Davis. In the week since our last broadcast, two press releases have caught my eye. The first was from the Institute of Fiscal Studies and claimed that this period of austerity is now likely to last until 2020. And the second was the news that UK bank lending to businesses is continuing to fall, despite the government's funding for lending scheme, which has now been in place for nearly a year. Given this unpromising environment, how should business owners, particularly those with small businesses, respond? In today's show, we'll be looking at the experiences of three local SMEs which have taken the plunge and made game-changing investments despite the economic downturn. We discuss why they decided to go for growth at such a challenging time, how they funded it, what obstacles they encountered along the way, and most importantly, and with the benefit of hindsight, whether it was worth it. My first contributor is Michael Wells, founder of Third Light Limited, based in Waterbeach.
So my background was as an engineer at Cambridge University, and in the late 90s when I graduated, the internet was notably a very much a bubble environment, so there were a lot of opportunities. And so I gained all sorts of skills working in internet systems and web systems at that point. As the bubble burst, I moved out of that and into other things, including working with early digital photography at a professional level, and started Third Light as a company which would actually help solve the management problems that produces. If you imagine, you start to accumulate large volumes of files, pictures. At that stage, there were no solutions really available for companies that needed to take control of digital media.
And this is where this acronym DAM comes in.
Yeah, so just said as DAM, it means Digital Asset Management. It's a slightly long-winded way of basically saying photo library software, but with the flexibility that you can store videos or PDFs, marketing brochures. If you imagine all the different things that businesses, rather than consumers or individuals, would actually use digital media for. And the point of it really is to centralise. Underneath all of this is the idea that if you can bring everything in one place, you will gain the ability to manage it more easily across teams of people, maybe with suppliers, maybe with people who don't even work in the same country. You put it in one place, you put a web interface almost certainly on the front of that. And that produces time saving, makes things a lot easier to find. And it's also a great business tool for people who are trying to have a consistent brand and promote the use of the right photos with the right copyright controls.
And so what Third Light does is provide the storage space in a cloud, yeah. to use the jargon, and also then the web front end that the purchaser of the system can use to manage their materials.
That's right, yeah. So it's a software product, but we are also a service provider. So we have a private cloud where we can store terabytes of content for our customers. So we can take that IT problem away and basically offer it as a managed service. So interestingly, before the term cloud was in use, we were already doing this. So since about 2003, we've been running these shared storage systems and trying to completely eliminate the IT overheads of doing this, because some of the problems that it involves are rather interesting. You know, there's a lot of IT problems nestling away under mass storage on the internet.
And the storage issue is really where the piece of the picture that I'm interested in for this show comes into play. So the program is about investment decisions in a recession, and for you, the costs of your kit are critical to the business.
They're absolutely critical. If you take a business model like ours, what we're really doing is saying that the overheads of setting up and managing this platform, this private cloud, can be shared out by essentially leasing part of it to every customer that needs to use it. And it's very much in our interest to make that experience a good one, but also to keep the cost of it as low as possible so that, as a business, we can be more profitable. Now, what we've seen is an evolution, and it's been extremely rapid. Since, particularly after 2006-07, where hardware started to consume dramatically less power, and at the same time still deliver more performance than ever before. Similarly, with hard disk storage, we're seeing that explosive growth, driven by digital media. The market internationally isn't just for business storage. So what we're finding is that we can renew perfectly serviceable, functional equipment with new equipment, and within a very short space of time, that pays for itself. And that's our investment decision, really, even against the difficulties of a recession, is to keep lowering our operating costs by using the best equipment that's available. And the advantages to us are very, very significant, at least a halving between, say, 4 years ago and today, to do probably four or five times as much work, more computation, more storage, for the same money.
This is all privately funded because the company is entirely privately held, and so it's a question of, you know, building up your war chest to keep rolling this stuff out.
Yes, yeah, so you've got to be a little bit successful to be able to do it this way. What we try to do is never to borrow money from anyone. And so, yeah, it's all retained income. But of course, it's a very virtuous circle. If you invest, you should expect to get a return. And for us, it's a very simple argument. We're not being short-term about it. It's actually worth it. Within 18 months, it's worth it. So it's a very simple choice. And it's definitely something that I would recommend businesses that have old servers should consider.
In terms of the clients who are benefiting from this investment, you've got a wide range of players in different sectors. Can you tell us a little bit about maybe some examples and how they use your services?
Sure. One of the things about digital asset management is the very, very wide variety of things that people use it for. So, for example, around Cambridge, we're working with Cambridge University and Anglia Ruskin University. And they're using it as a portfolio of marketing assets, particularly if you think about the prospectuses that they send out to new students, where they've got to be very careful about the photos they use and the copyright that's attached to those. So it's a tool that helps them in a marketing sense. But equally, we're working with a local punting company, Scudamore's, and they're using it as a tool for engaging with tourists. And of course, because they're using a lot of photography of the backs and they need to accumulate that and keep hold of it, it's useful for them to be able to centralise it, mm-hmm. and be able to push it out to the printers. So locally, you know, there's a few examples, but many of our customers are actually international. And we've seen a trend really away from sales in the UK as the recession has bitten fairly hard, but very buoyant demand from the States, even from quite big brands like Cisco and Fujitsu, Nike, where we're doing quite high-level marketing storage systems for them. On the other hand, you know, variety is the incredible spice of life at third light. When the phone rings, we really have no idea what the question will be. And I think a completely different example that we've been working with for over 7 years now is a large dam construction project in Laos, where a team of people are auditing the progress of construction by taking periodic photographs. The idea being that if a huge crack appears in the front of the dam, they'll be able to turn the clock back using these photographs that they've stored in the system and actually look at the evolution of the fault. Nothing at all to do with marketing there, and that just illustrates the very, very diverse ways people do tend to use this stuff.
And just to give us an idea of the scale of some of these projects, I mean, the dam example, how many images have accrued over the course of the 7 years?
Well, they're taking upwards of 2,000 a week, so it's really very large numbers. But it's very much a niche. You know, we can never generalise about what our customers are going to do with this stuff. What we're doing is producing the means or the tools to make it possible for them.
And I gather that you're quite keen to support local businesses who want to start moving into this area and using your services. So what kinds of applications can you see there?
One of the things that we're doing at the moment involves offering server storage space or actually physical equipment space here at our offices, where we've opened a new data centre on site, which is very convenient for us. But it's a little bit bigger than we actually need.
At the moment,
yeah. And so we have some spare capacity that we're willing to share with other businesses.
This is In Your Company on Cambridge 105 with me, Sam Davis. Michael makes both the rationale behind Third Light's investment programme and the process itself sound very straightforward. But I wanted to find out whether the same would be true for companies outside the high-tech business services sector. So I met Rocco Balzano, the owner of Balzano's Delicatessen and Bakery on Cherry Hinton Road. The shop was set up by Rocco's parents, who emigrated to Cambridge from Italy in the early 1960s. But Rocco and his wife Becky have invested heavily to underpin a major expansion of the business in the last couple of years. My apologies for the sound quality on this clip.
You have always been involved in the store. I mean, it was a family business and
yes.
You kind of came through.
Yep, I left school at 15, didn't do any exams, so went straight into work. Been working in the shop ever since.
And your father kind of handed the store over to you when, about 2001?
Yep, that's right. He was 60 and decided that he'd had enough. And I'd been sort of running it for the last 4 years previous to that with his oversight and overview. We took it over completely then.
At that stage, you decided to put your stamp on it by doing a...
refurb, yep. We refurbed the old shop. For the first time, and on limited funds, so we did the best we could, made it slightly bigger, slightly more of a nicer shopping environment and experience, and yeah, that went well.
But it was still at that stage, I guess, what you'd call a kind of grocer's. So you had the deli and the bakery, but you were also selling a lot of sort of standard.
Yes, there were because the area didn't have many supermarkets or shops, so we sold with our Italian bread, we sold Fairy Liquid, Andrex toilet paper, and that went well because of convenience, and a lot of the little old ladies would come in the shop and buy things like that as they were buying their bread.
But then you and your wife Becky, who was on the scene by this point,
yep.
Over the course of the next 10 years, kind of detected signs that the neighbourhood was changing and it might be time to make some more significant changes.
Yeah, well, we noticed the whole area was becoming much more affluent, and Cambridge was becoming more affluent. It wasn't so much a student town anymore, but more of more businesses were coming up, Arm, all that kind of businesses, the Silicon Fen that is now, and we noticed that people wanted more higher quality food. Also, in the English market, was getting much better, so the small producers were producing really nice cheeses and jams and pickles, so we wanted to get those in. And also, Tesco's opened at the top of the road, so that sort of took a lot of the convenience products away from us, because people would go there. So we thought we'd make something a bit nicer, a little bit more upmarket.
So is it interesting that the Tesco's opening was something that struck you as an opportunity rather than a threat? Were you quite confident of your core market even at that stage?
No. I don't know if I thought it was an opportunity, but I thought the sort of convenience products were just dwindling and dwindling and dwindling. Less and less people were coming. But what we noticed were that people were still coming to us, but for our specialty foods. So obviously we thought, let's do that better and more of it, and hope that would encourage people to come to us continuously. And also, I'd noticed in the market a lot of my competitors were also moving into the coffee area, the cake area, and the coffee and cake, and the sit-down area. So I thought that was a good move to go as well. Well, I hoped it would be a good move.
Okay, so if I can recap, you've got supermarket moving in, taking away a lot of your standard business. You've got competitors expanding their businesses in the same direction that you're thinking of going in. And you've got a not terribly helpful economic climate. I mean, we all know Cambridge is in something of a bubble. But these don't strike me as kind of terribly auspicious circumstances to start what was a major investment programme.
Yes. Well,
are you just an optimist?
I am a bit of an optimist, but also I'm very, very lucky that we own the building. My parents bought the building 40 years ago. So we're in quite a good position. So any money invested in the building would always be an investment and always have value. So it was a bit of a calculated risk. That it would work. And also a lot of my customers would literally, in my old shop, and we had no seating and coffee, they would come and they would stand and chat for 20, 30 minutes. And I would jokingly say to them, fancy a coffee? And they would say, oh, that would be nice. And so I could see that there was a market, and there isn't really anywhere to sit and have coffee in this area. I kind of thought it was there, the market was there.
But
you got to put your money where your mouth is, which was a bit more difficult.
And you did, because I gather that the whole expansion and refurbishment was funded pretty much exclusively from...
Pretty much self-funded. We started with a figure and a fund that we had, which we weren't going to go over, but we eventually obviously did, as you do when you do these projects. So we were shortfall about 50,000-60,000, phoned the bank, and they were very happy to lend it to us.
All right, so let's give a positive name check to a bank here.
Yep, Lloyds Bank. Yep, phoned them up. They literally gave me the money overnight, so it was really, really good.
Well, that's very, very lucky. That's a very encouraging message.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would say, the only caveat to that is that we've been in business for 30 years, always been profitable. We own the building, so they took security of the building, obviously. You know, I'm not a startup business who doesn't own the building. Though they did lend me the money overnight and without any quibble, they hedged a pretty good bet. I mean, you know, that's probably the only thing I would say. They were very kind to me, lend me the money, no problem.
But I don't think kind comes into it. Saw you as a good commercial prospect.
I think that's what it is, and I think that's the problem, is that a lot of startup businesses can't get the funding, and that's the problem, because, you know, with us they had a lot of security, so they were quite happy to lend it to us, and that's the difference.
So now, looking at it from the perspective of an expanded operation which has been up and running for the best part of 2 years now, was it worth the aggravation and the investment?
Absolutely, yes it was. We've doubled our turnover, it's going very, very well.
So, the experience of expansion has also been positive for the Balzanos, and if you drop into their shop, you will spot a beautiful photo montage documenting the building work and dedicating it to Rocco's parents. And as you can see from my photo on the In Your Company Twitter feed, the cappuccino there is also a work of art. But now on to the perspective of my third interviewee, Helen Harrison, the principal and owner of Granta Dental in Newnham. The story of Granta Dental's investment programme is undoubtedly the most complex of the three businesses featured today, which reflects the particular constraints of working in such a highly regulated sector.
People often ask me why I chose dentistry, but I like it because it's about people, and I always wanted to do something with people. What I realised was the way that I wanted to do it didn't necessarily fit with a rigid framework of perhaps an existing practice, and so I decided to start a practice myself.
So this is what, early 1990s?
1990.
And this was a private practice?
No, I started as an NHS practice. I looked for an area of Cambridge which was then quite a much quieter, more markety sort of town that didn't have a dental practice, and I identified Newnham as being an area of Cambridge that was a high residential area but didn't actually have a dental practice. And so I was fortunate to find some offices that I was able to convert, and I set up and I just basically put my plate on the door and built a practice from people who came to see me because they wanted to build a relationship with a dentist. They wanted the personal service.
You set up your practice on Newnham Road.
Yeah.
You already had a feel for the kind of dentistry that you wanted to pursue. The practice was very successful. The premises were, well, I think bijou is probably the word, isn't it?
Yes, to say the least, because we had a nice contained premises, but it was too small for the range of things that I gradually discovered I wanted to offer. I've always invested. I enjoy the toys. I like having really good technology, good equipment, anything that can make the experience better, the quality of what we do better. I tried hard to make it fit within the building that we had, because that made it very much more cost effective, but it just got to be ridiculous. And looking at what people were starting to need, and what I could see was the knock-on effect of their treatment, things that we could potentially offer, ideas I had, my vision. I just couldn't realise it within that small space.
And so you came to that realisation when? About 2007?
Seven or eight. I started looking, and of course premises do come up, but then it's fitting them to the actual need. Something doesn't come up on the market available, whether to lease, rent or buy, that is already set up as a dental practice. It's a very specialist requirement and has got complex needs.
The picture you're painting is of wanting to expand at a point when locating premises in Cambridge was becoming more and more difficult, yeah, because demand was taking off there, in a sector that was becoming increasingly regulated, and at a time when the economic conditions were starting to get tighter. And as a private practice, clearly you must have had some concerns about whether that was going to have an impact on you or not.
Of course, because people have to make choices, and dentistry can be one of those things that it's quite easy to say, perhaps I won't do it this month or won't do it this year, I'm all right. And then, of course, that's a problem. So we knew that in conjunction with expanding and pursuing that vision, we actually had to be sure that we were offering people something that really was worth making an effort for. And so we had to set out and think about what our clients and our patients were actually looking for and where their needs were, where needs weren't perhaps elsewhere being met.
You found the premises that we're currently sitting in 2011, is that right?
Yes.
So that was a 4-year journey from the tipping point of we need new premises to actually identifying something that worked for you.
Two previous sets of premises that we got all the way to getting planning permission and designs up for ready to go, but then foundered either because we couldn't raise the finance to do what we wanted to do, or there was some problem with leases or some legal problem. So we had two major projects leading up to that, during which I had to do a refurbishment of my existing premises because it had become unfit for purpose, because we'd sort of thought, we're moving soon, we won't do that. And eventually I had to look after my staff and my patients and make sure. So we refurbished the existing premises and decided to sit on our heels and just watch for a bit. And no sooner had we done that refurbishment than the building that we're sitting in now, which I'd actually been looking at out of my surgery window ever since 1997 and thinking, I wonder whether those offices would ever come available. Suddenly I got a phone call from an estate agent to say 39 Newnham Road is coming up for lease.
So you went for it, and just to give people listening an idea of the scale of the expansion, in your old premises, I think you had two consulting rooms.
Yep.
And here you have
four dental consulting rooms and three other treatment rooms, which don't have dental chairs in them.
But have, for example, imaging equipment? Or...
No, those I've got, in addition to that, we've got an imaging room so we can do x-rays and things in a proper set room. And we've also got a small laboratory so we can do repairs and things for people, a short turnaround without having to send them out somewhere else.
And I'm assuming that fitting out a dental consulting room does not come cheap.
No, the basic dental consulting room, you don't get much change out of £50,000 for just a basic dental consulting room. That's without all the reception, the computing and all the other things, the infrastructure that has to be there.
So how was that significant expansion funded then?
Bank loan. And equipment can typically be leased so that you maintain the value of it, of the equipment itself is held in the lease, because dental equipment looked after will hold its value pretty well. So if it's well maintained, so we can get leasing agreements for certain of the equipment, which is quite tax efficient as well. And then the rest of it was out of retained profits. Because I enjoy what I do so much, I've always been prepared to invest back into my business. And I've always done that quite heavily. I enjoy it. It's my life. So I was able to do that. I had enough reserved profits from previous year's trading that we put into that. And the bank actually insisted on us having that before they would lend to us.
So would you say that the bank were supportive of you, given that you had a 20-year trading history?
I didn't get the feeling that I had a loyalty bonus, if you like, from that long history. I felt like I was treated according to market conditions. Having said that, the bank that I use do view healthcare, dentistry as a very solid sort of industry, and people are not going to run out of the need for getting their teeth fixed, however much they'd like to put it off. And so so the bank were able to look after me and satisfy what I needed. They had an appreciation of how much investment I needed to put in and how solid the business would be. But I wouldn't say they gave me special terms, no.
Okay, I won't ask you to name them. And the refurbishment took the best part of a year.
Yes.
You opened in July 2012 in the new premises.
Yeah.
So we're sitting very nearly a year on from that. Was it worth it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because I've got space to actually do the things that I want to do properly. So if I want to look after somebody in a particular way, I want to offer them some extra care and extra services which actually complement and help with the dentistry, provide a better service for the local community, actually identifying those needs. I've got space to do it.
What kinds of things are we talking about here?
Well, we've introduced osteopathy. When I discovered that a lot of people felt the knock-on effects very often of the dentistry, and had a lot of interrelated effects with some of the discomforts and problems that they would have with their teeth, with their back or their neck or headaches. We've discovered that a lot of people were seeing an osteopath as well, and we thought, why not actually integrate that to what we're doing? People find that there's lots of things they'd like to be able to do to actually help their own health, and proactive things that people want to be involved in, a more holistic approach. We can satisfy so much of that because I've come across more people who've got ideas and things that they can offer, and instead of saying, oh, I'd love to be able to do that and how can we work, we can say, come and join us, we've got space, we can roll out some additional services, we can respond to the needs.
So despite the inevitable setbacks along the way, the message from all three of today's guests seems to be far more positive than I'd anticipated. Self-funding is the simplest way of financing investment, but their experiences suggest that bank funding is available to established businesses with collateral and a good track record. And all three businesses are very clear on the significant benefits they have gained in a relatively short time frame from taking the risk of expanding. I'm very grateful to Michael, Rocco and Helen for sharing their experiences today. The next edition of In Your Company will be on Saturday the 13th of July, when we'll be continuing this theme by talking to the chairman of a local bank which specialises in funding SMEs and to an insolvency practitioner who helps businesses pick up the pieces when it all goes wrong. In the meantime, if you have any questions or feedback, please email us. Our address is inyourcompany@cambridge105.fm. You can also follow us on Twitter @inyourcompany. All the previous editions of In Your Company are available as podcasts on the Cambridge 105 website. Thanks for listening and goodbye.